everybody. This is B-Sol of the Vault of Horror, and I am welcoming you back to Conversations in the Dark as part of the Vaultcast. Tonight, I'm very excited. Well, I'm always excited, as you can tell, when I do these things. But tonight, I really am especially excited because I am bringing somebody on board here who has been a part of the Vault of Horror almost from the beginning. And we're going to be talking about something that I know he has no shortage of opinions and ideas about. So this should be a really good one. The guest is my high school buddy, Ray, who you may know as Ray Ray, who used to contribute a lot to the Vault of Horror in his pre-parenthood days, which I can relate to. And I have lured him back into the confines of the vault to discuss his all-time favorite movie, and really a lot of horror fans' all-time favorite movie, honestly, and that is John Carpenter's The Thing. And the reason I'm excited is that Ray has seen this movie about a million times, as I'm sure a lot of people listening have, and he has a lot to say about it. So this should really be genuinely fascinating because I also have a lot of questions about it because I just rewatched it at Ray's request. And so it's really fresh on both of our minds. And so I'll just start off by saying I'm sure anybody listening to this is very familiar with The Thing, the remake of a 1950s horror classic by John Carpenter, and probably the best movie that he ever made. And it has provoked endless speculation and pontification in the last 30 years. And it's also easily the trademark, or rather, it is the epitome of the good sequel. I mean, the good remake, rather. And most of the time in horror, remakes are a very bad idea. This movie is the classic textbook example of when it is a very good idea. So anyway, without further ado, I want to stop talking for a minute and bring on my buddy, Ray. Welcome to the Vault of Horror. Welcome back, Ray.
It's great to be back. I even stopped writing on my own lousy blog like a year and a half ago. I just didn't have the time to sit there and, you know, pound out stuff on the keyboard anymore, you know? I'm glad you brought me back for this. The thing is, it's my favorite horror movie, and I don't really have a favorite movie. I just sort of have like this like revolving pantheon of what I go, oh, that's one of my favorite movies. And it's in like the highest rarefied air of that, you know, like along with many other movies. Another movie that's in that genre, you know, area with me too is Alien. Yes. I think it edges out Alien, Ridley Scott's classic, which is apparently being prequelized as we speak.
Yes, it is.
But, as you said, it is the way to do a remake, and some might even say it's not even really a remake. It's really actually going back to the original source material of Campbell's short story novella, Who Goes There?
That's true. It is based a lot more on directly on that story than on the film. Although, you know, Carpenter is such a fan of the original that, you know, there's a lot of nods that are thrown in there.
Absolutely. The people have pointed out there's a great ebook on a website that I am in no way connected to, and I don't think I'm even a member on. I'm a lurker called outpost31.com. Mm-hmm. And there's a PDF ebook that I referred you to called All About the Thing, where yes, the author, his name slips my mind, does like a moment-by-moment dissection of The Thing. And anybody who's turned on by The Thing, who likes this conversation that we're about to have for hopefully at least an hour, hopefully more, should even refer themselves to that ebook, which is, I think the guy like loves it to have it freely disseminated around. I recently rewatched The Thing when Brian asked me to do this, and I made 5 pages of legal pad notes, which I will be referring to multiple times. You know.
Well, why do you think? Well, let me put it this way to you. Before, I wanted to just quickly, first of all, because it's on my mind. We talked about the hints of the original movie in this one. And I mean, this really is like a reinvention, but there are certain things. Obviously, the title card, is identical, which was so cool that they did that. It also makes the same noise, doesn't it? When Bennings is taken over, Isn't the noise that comes out of it?
Maybe a little bit, but I think the James Arness iteration is more just like more of a regular scream. There's sort of like I was thinking about it too. The roar or the scream of the thing is it's otherworldly, but it also has that like intangible quality, almost like you remember the Tyrannosaurus Rex in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like anything that you thought it would sound like. It doesn't sound like a roar that you ever heard anywhere else.
Right.
It has that kind of like sonorous, like almost like a horn.
Yeah.
Sound to it.
Yeah, I always felt like with the thing with the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park is they were paying close attention to the connection that dinosaurs have with birds. I think that they made them sound like giant birds. Like it almost sounds like if a goose was 80 feet tall, that's the noise it would make. You know what I mean?
I never thought of it like that. But, you know, the thing is another one of those creatures that it has, you know, that... And a lot of times it's like a two-tone. Like, both Bennings and I think the dog thing have like a two-tone, like, mm-hmm. a thing going on.
It's a strange sound effect.
There's two pans to a thing from another world that are obvious, though. And one of them is when they're looking on the videotape of the Norwegians, of them spreading out circular around the saucer in the ice.
Yes.
And, of course, the ice block.
Yes.
Those are the two most obvious.
And that was almost like – what's interesting about that, and I noticed it when I watched it again, is now when they first discover that ice block, you haven't seen the creature yet in the movie. So, so the thing about it is, though, it's almost like Carpenter knows that if you've seen the original, you're coming in with these preconceived notions, and when you see the ice block, you're thinking it's going to be something very similar to the creature in the original, and it sets you up to be completely shocked by what it actually is, which is something far beyond that.
Well, I was making, I think everybody who's ever seen it made this observation, but... The way the thing looks, especially in particular the dog thing and the Norris thing, are they're astonishing creatures. They are creatures that are so weird and so formless that they literally are things. They are blobs of like protoplasm. They are completely out of this world. Well, and one of the kickers that I realized, and I've seen this movie at least 50 times, if not more, one thing I realized is the dog thing, they don't know it's from outer space yet.
Right.
That could have been a bad disease from a fucking penguin.
Yep, they have no idea what it is yet. I don't know if they ever fully realize what it is, honestly. The alien thing is
they don't know it's from outer space at that point.
Right.
It was still, as far as they were concerned, a terrestrial phenomenon.
Well, here's a question I have now, because you mentioned how they don't, how otherworldly it is, or how completely alien it is. This is something that occurred to me watching it. I mean, would you say that it is intelligent, and is it self-aware? In other words, are the creatures that are the thing, are they aware even that they are the thing, or do they think they're human?
There's a lot of debate about this. There's a few, and I even forwarded to you a very good short story that takes on this subject, which is The Thing from the Thing's perspective, called Things.
Yes.
That's also open source. I think you get it on Clark's World. Again, another website I have zero connection to. I think, yes, it's certainly a self-aware creature. It is not a disease. It's not a virus. That's what it is. It's a creature that replicates like that. If you want evidence of that, direct evidence of its thinking, it's easy to point out. There's points in the movie, and I'd like to get into it a little later on, when two things are communicating to you directly in front of you. That's the Norris thing and the Palmer thing. And then there's what Blair does, which is, I'm going to go build a spaceship. Okay, I'm going to build the same spaceship I was on.
That's a whole other can of worms that I do plan to get into with you, is the whole Blair situation. But the thing with the thing, I'm going to keep saying thing, But
you can't help it. Once you start discussing the topic, you realize you become conscious of it.
I'm never sure if it's actually aware, because there are scenes where it is. It almost seems like the alien part of it is triggered when it's threatened, but other times it's dormant somehow. Like, okay, the guy who, I'm sorry, I don't know all the names as well as you, the stoner guy, what's his name?
Palmer.
Okay, Palmer. Now, Palmer is at one point, he's a thing. Now, in the scene where Norris becomes a thing, right, and comes out and all his parts and everything, he's the one that has the famous line when the head is crawling across the floor, "You got to be fucking kidding me." Now,
right.
At that moment, he is a thing.
Right.
Am I
actually,
right?
I was just rereading that ebook I was speaking about, and I just passed through that part. It's a large ebook. It's like 140 pages. So, coincidentally, I just passed that part. And what that writer postulates, and I've always agreed with once I realized that at that point Palmer is a thing, is that Palmer is a perfect imitation. All right? He's been a thing a long time at that point.
Yeah.
He's completely assimilated, and he's doing his best to hide. So he does exactly what Palmer would do.
Okay.
B, that's sort of like, I know that Norris just got wasted, and if I could distract attention from me slightly, I'm going to point out the little head thing. Oh, look.
So you think it's a very calculated move.
Everything the thing does is extremely calculated.
It's trying to make sure that they believe that it's not, he is human.
Yeah. The thing, let's go back to the beginning of the movie. You have the dog. What does the dog do? The dog runs to where there's another camp. It had to figure out that there was another camp in the direction to run to. Right?
Yes.
Okay. It gets there, and I tried to figure out if it jumps up on Bennings. I really don't think that there's any reason why it jumps up on Bennings, just besides that Bennings is the first guy it runs up to. But I watched it a few times. Like, I really tried to pull apart the movie on last Friday. And but then it is a very calculating creature. It's obvious in the first 20 minutes of the movie that there's something wrong with this dog, and this dog is definitely not what it looks like.
So is it limited by the intellect of a dog, though?
No, absolutely not. Because what does he do? That dog is watching them. There's scenes in the beginning, okay? Let's see. The dog is first seen under the ping pong table. That's the first time you see it after the first scene with the Norwegians.
Yes. When
right?
Playing,
they show it twice sitting under that table. They return to it twice. It knows the chopper is taking off and where the chopper is probably going to. It's not stupid. Okay?
Yeah.
When it returns, when they return from the Norwegian camp, it's standing at the window.
Yes.
Okay? And they return to it twice. There's two views of it. Okay? They. John Carpenter. Okay? When they're doing the presentation, and we found this, it's standing in the doorway. At that point, it's standing in the doorway. In the interim, while they were at the Norwegian camp, it makes its attack. It lurks around. First of all, it goes quiet. It's a quiet dog, obviously. It's not the kind of dog that draws attention to itself.
Right.
Okay? Didn't do anything like that. In fact, the only time it drew attention to itself, it got put in the dog cage. Was that a calculated act? I just thought of that right now.
It wanted to be in there.
Me get in trouble. I'm going to push up against Bennings again.
Yeah.
Maybe hit his wound.
Yeah, now, okay. Now, that reminds me. I was doing a little reading up and trying to figure out, you know, the ways in which the characters are assimilated. Now, it looks like there's the more aggressive form of assimilation, which is what we see happens to, you know, Bennings, where it literally physically absorbs
your puncture.
Right. But then there seems to be another way where it could almost infect you in a very slow and subtle way and start to take over your cell structure.
I was thinking of that. I do not think that the thing can do that. And I only base it on pure conjecture. This is you know, Superman versus Mighty Mouse. Okay. But I tend to believe that movies are their own, I mean, this might sound stupid, their own canon. Meaning, what the film shows you is what the rules are of that universe. And that means the nature of the thing is to have these tentacles. And if you look at, and I made this observation, so this kind of like, I guess, when the dog thing attacks and they first start to respond to that, okay, and they have the flashlights in there, and when MacReady and Gary start to shoot the dogs and the dog thing, there's one dog that's kind of like still a dog, but it has a tentacle going around it.
Yes.
Okay? It has a tentacle also going into its throat.
Yes.
Okay? I never actually made that particular observation. When Bennings is attacked, you get that flash of Bennings in the storage room, and he's wrapped up, and there's a tentacle coming out of his mouth. If the thing doesn't need to attack you in order to assimilate you, if it could just cough on you and turn you into things, that's what the thing would do. So that means it can't be so casual. It isn't a bubonic plague thing. It's I have to overwhelm your cellular structure. I have to overwhelm your immune system. Okay? You could probably fight off a case of the thing. But if the thing has got itself wrapped up and it's got all the, you know, think of what happened to Windows. Windows had the big, you know, like the Palmer thing, things out. And
chewing on his head.
Literally. And that wasn't to kill him. That was to thing him. I'm going to thing your ass, and then I'm going to get you, MacReady, and then the rest of you people I have in my pledge. You know? That's right. My thought on it. You know, the nature of the thing, if it could just cough on you and turn you into a thing, that's what it would do.
Do you think it's a communal mind, or are they individuals?
I think that it's... I think it could be since it's an alien, it could be both. I think that it's sort of like a weird mixture of the hive mind, but it could be individual, you know, like the Palmer thing, you know? Screw you, little head. I'm getting away with more, but now... Think of the ice block, right? And this is another thing I really hadn't thought about. But if you think of the ice block, and I'm sure this is going to come out. I haven't seen the prequel yet. I had a wedding to go to when the prequel came out, and then I just never got around to seeing it. And the mixed reviews kind of put me off. And I see some really cool scenes, clips from it, and I see some ones that are like, yeah, that's really not very thingy.
See, what I heard, the big problem with this prequel, and I also have not seen it, but what I've heard is, the problem is that it's very, very obvious who the infected people are. It's not like in the original where, like, I mean, I can't speak on it because I haven't seen it, but that is what one of the criticisms I have heard about it.
Well, if you look at the ice block, this was my point I was getting to. If you look at the ice block, whatever was in that ice block was pretty huge. Yeah. It had a lot of body mass. And by the time it got to Outpost 31, its body mass was that of an average husky. And I think body mass is an important aspect of the thing, because the thing goes about and obtains, by the end of the thing, a very large body mass in the Blair Monster.
Yes.
Okay, it coalesces all the body mass it can get to create the one big creature that it's going to go for the showdown. So, I mean, body mass is obviously a thing that it's into, I guess. It's a concern for it, but it's also willing to, you know, the dog part comes out of it. And that dog thing was going to, from the Blair Monster, yeah. It was there to go attack MacReady, you know. And if you saw the, you know, some of the cut scenes, like the stop animation that they had of it coming out of the Blair Monster's chest, that dog was supposed to, you know, leap out and start crawling across the ice towards...
Yeah.
MacReady, which would have been, like, you know, really insane. You know, in retrospect, the Blair Monster is cool and really, you know, screwed up looking, but sort of like a letdown compared to the dog thing and the Norris thing, which are two of, like, the most insane creatures ever.
Ah, okay.
I think the you know, except for the belly biting teeth thing, I think the dog thing is off the charts.
Now,
as far as a monster goes.
What happens to the Norris thing? Why does it die? Why does the body die?
Norris had a heart condition.
Is that all it was?
It perfectly assimilated a creature with a defect.
Is it established that he has a heart condition? I don't remember
that. In the script, he had a heart condition.
Oh, I see. Okay. I don't remember that. And okay, so that would explain that a little bit. Because I assumed that it was because it had not perfectly completed its in other words, it screwed up.
No, rather it was too perfect.
Too perfect.
Too perfect.
Now,
these are some of the reasons why I love the thing. Now, I first saw the thing probably in like 86. It came out in 82, so I was probably like 10, 11, right? And it scared the bejesus out of me. I had never seen a movie that scared me so badly as The Thing. No movie, except for maybe The Shining, did this to me. The Exorcist. Too. And only one book I ever read did it to me, and that's because I read it as a really young child, which was Pet Sematary.
Oh, yes.
It gives you this black pit in your belly is how scared I was when I watched The Thing. And as I've watched it over the years, you know, and returned to it, like, I thought about it. If I had to describe The Thing, it would be, like, 10 little Indians crossed with 12 angry men with, you know, the most vicious space monster of all time, you know?
Yes, I love the 12 angry men idea. I never even thought of that. That's great.
It's all this stuff, like, you asked me to do this, so I did my homework, and I come up with some good lines.
Well, you know, you mentioned, this made me think of a post I did, you mentioned the alien thing, you know, alien versus The Thing and that whole issue. I've come to the conclusion over the years that I know the second one is like this in the alien films. The second one is like the sexier one that everybody likes to talk about. But really, the one that stands the test of time is the first one, in my opinion. It is a better film.
It's a better film, but there's a lot to. I'm a big fan of both movies.
I am too.
I love both movies, but I love them like in different ways.
The first one is so strong for me for the same reason. It's the same reason that The Thing is, and it's because it has this incredible ensemble cast. That is why it's so good. And I did a post where I actually compared the two casts.
That's a tough call because really the cast is excellent for Alien.
Yeah.
And
the cast of The Thing is a little bit bigger.
But Alien is a great film, and I think overall is a film superior to Aliens in that it is still more atmosphere. But the atmosphere comes around in Aliens once the Marines get beat. Then all of a sudden, now we're back into atmosphere. But where Alien, as far as in the same genre, I think looses out to The Thing. Now the casts, I think, is a watch because they're both great, and they're both like this. It's like let's find all the character actors that we have at hand, and let's just throw them into this thing. The only one who was missing in either of those movies is Brian Cox.
he would have been great in every other movie, but those two. He was busy being Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. Right. is that they spent the money on the special effects for Alien, on the spaceship, and the scenery. You know, the scenes inside the alien spaceship and the scenes of their spaceship itself are very convincing. They didn't have that setting aspect in The Thing. Rather, they spent their special effects money on Rob Bottin and the other guy whose name I forget, who did the dog thing. And that's where they spent most of their money.
Was it Stan Winston?
I think you might be right. He did the dog thing because Bottin was running behind. And I've never seen, and I'm not an expert on the subject, but I've never seen special effects, which is essentially puppetry, either mechanical or human-driven puppetry, that is as convincing and maintains its believability to today.
Yeah.
Okay, I've gotten to the age where since I, and therefore by extension you, are almost 40. I look back on the movies that we watched in the 80s, and I sometimes judge them by does it hold up? And there are some movies that don't hold up. And The Thing holds up in spades. And one movie I saw recently, within the last year, that came out and ruined the party just before the thing, which was E.T. Yeah. E.T. ruined the thing. If the thing came out 6 months later, it would have been a huge blockbuster.
Yeah, the thing was a bomb, was it not?
Yeah, it was not only was it a bomb, it was roundly criticized in the film media. Like, I think Roger Ebert's gone back and given it a thumbs up, but he gave it a thumbs down as a gore. It's not a gory movie.
Well, that's what he did with Night of the Living Dead too.
Yeah, awesome, good job. And I think people were into Happy Aliens and not, you know, they were into what was the Spielberg had Close Encounters of the Third Kind had just come out a couple years before that. Everything was all shiny and happy aliens, and nobody wanted ugly, gross, you know, I'm going to grow teeth out of tongue aliens. And I go back and I watch E.T. E.T. doesn't hold up.
Ray, I don't agree with you. I do not agree with you.
It's a Steven Spielberg story without it's a Steven Spielberg story with no story.
I think E.T. is a great movie. You can call me a sap all you want.
I'm a sap. That's not good. It's not a good movie. Here's some of my other observations that you might find interesting.
Okay.
First of all, is that getting back to the pay-ons, is he kept it a flying saucer. He has the most weirdest alien in the universe, and he uses a flying saucer. I think that's an interesting choice on his part.
That's true.
The second really interesting... and somebody must have written this before. I'm not this clever, but MacReady, the first time you see MacReady is he's pouring himself a scotch. He's putting ice in a scotch in the middle of the Antarctic and playing chess against a computer. And I freeze framed the position he was in. And he was in a position that was like Nathan 2. There was nothing he could do about it. He was a lost cause.
Yep.
It was a completely lost cause, but he keeps playing. So his position in the game is done, but he makes his last move anyway. And then he gets mated, and then he destroys his inhuman opponent. And yeah, that right there is like a synopsis for what is going to happen in the movie.
It's the Kobayashi Maru.
It's the movie, you know, Rick Small.
Yes.
You know?
He cannot accept the no-win scenario. He's very Kirk-like.
No, he's willing to make you think you won, and then he's going to blow you up. Mm-hmm. the Norwegians came close to saving the world. You realize that all that was left was a dog.
Yeah, God only knows what they went through. Although when you see the prequel, I guess you see what they went through.
Right. But they're terrible marksmen. Unlike Gary, Gary probably was a professional soldier. As was probably MacReady. MacReady probably saw time in Vietnam, as some people.
That's a safe bet, yeah.
You know, and I don't know if Gary did, but Gary, these guys have a rifle and can't hit a dog at 30 feet. Gary has a pistol and shoots a guy through the eye.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a big deal to somebody that knows a little bit about shooting. So, Gary is a professional, and maybe not professional, but he is a practiced marksman. And Gary is an affable leader who has the skills it takes to enforce his will. It's just, does he have the will to do it?
Yeah.
Another thing I thought of was, although you know why the Norwegians didn't get on the radio and didn't tell anybody about this, is because the weather was so bad, because a scene after the helicopter blows up, you know, Windows is trying to get on the horn and he can't really talk to anybody in 2 weeks. But why didn't the Norwegians use the radio on the helicopter as they were circling? We have a space alien. Don't touch the dog. It's infected with a disease.
If only one of those guys spoke Norwegian, that would have been a short movie.
It's a little Norwegian.
Yeah.
Maybe Norris only spoke Norwegian because he was already a thing.
Oh, now you're giving me a headache. Yeah. Who is it that reads the side of the helicopter? Somebody can read the side of it and figures out they're Norwegian.
Norris is the one whose belly comes open. And yeah. He's also the one that goes to the spaceship. And he's also possibly one of the first, he is a candidate of two people for being the first assimilated person by the dog when the dog comes down the corridor.
Yeah.
You see the shadow? The shadow turns around. He's one of those two people that's most likely candidate for that having happened.
See, and you're supposed to assume, now you're supposed to assume that the person in that room is Clark.
Well,
Clark is the red herring.
He's fingered for good reason by Blair. However, I've given a lot of thought to Blair. Blair was most likely assimilated while he was left alone with the remains of the Norwegian from the Norwegian camp. After he did the autopsy, and he's sitting there in his lab, and he's doing his calculations. At one of those times, when he's alone with that, that's when he was probably assimilated.
Okay.
He was assimilated early on. But the first person assimilated is either, some say Norse, and some say, or you could say Palmer. It all has, and it has to do with the puffy hair. You see like a puffy hair dip. And nobody has a profile like just like that. But whoever's in that profile of that shadow on the wall, that silhouette, they have a DA kind of haircut at the time.
Yeah.
And that's the first victim.
Okay, now this is a huge can of worms now that I'm going to open because you brought it up. Probably the biggest question, the biggest source of debate in this movie is, when is Blair assimilated? That is the big question that everybody asks. Now, there's two schools of thought on this, apparently. One is that he was assimilated before he went crazy or anything. The other is that he doesn't get assimilated until he's locked up in the shed. In other words, he's still human when they lock him up. Now you're saying that he's already a thing by the time he's destroying all the equipment and everything.
I've recently come to be of that opinion.
So why does he seem to be... So while he's sitting there researching the thing and being fearful of what it can do and trying to cut them all off, he's already the thing?
Yeah, maybe.
Now, some people have said, and I've done the reading...
Maybe the thing's doing its own calculations. How quick can I get to the whole world?
Well, some people have said that he does that because he wants to, that he's a thing, and he wants to get locked up because it's the only way he could have enough privacy to build that ship.
That is, if you look, in the, you know, this is not purely my own train of thought, so I won't take credit for it, but in that ebook I referred to, Everything or All About the Thing, everything that Blair does when he, you know, when he acts out, the Blair acting out episode, does nothing to favor the people there or the rest of humanity. You know, you've destroyed, sure, okay, the thing, you know, the idea was he's going to protect the world by cutting the thing off. Well, the thing we know could freeze in the ice and stay there for 100,000 years. If it could stay there for 100,000 years, it could stay there for 100 million years. You haven't done humanity any favors by cutting off their communication. They cannot call for help. They cannot call warning. Hey, don't come here. We got a big outbreak of a bad disease. Don't come here. Do not send a rescue. Firebomb it. If you got a TAC nuke, hit it with a TAC nuke. All that ability is taken away by Blair. And exactly as you said, it allows Blair to destroy... ostensibly destroy machinery for the purposes of acting like he's saving the world, and then cannibalize those things.
Now this supports the idea that I had, which you don't agree with, that it can slowly infect you, because it almost seems like he is turning into the thing without even consciously being aware of it. In other words, there are times where it seems like his mind is being influenced to do things, and he doesn't even know the reason why. Like, he genuinely seems like he is fighting the outbreak of this creature, and he's trying these extreme measures. But really what he's doing is helping it. But I don't even think he realizes that he's helping it. You know what I mean? Or is that reading too much into it?
There's a certain weight to what you're saying, and also a certain horror cachet to that, you know, that the monster that slowly eats your mind and while it makes you do your bidding. But I, when I'm faced with this kind of possibilities, I'm still going to stick with my idea that the thing does what it does because that's what it has to do. If like Fuchs postulated at one point, that's the reserve biologist who just didn't have it. we need you to do something, Fuchs. I can't do it. I need Blair and Copper, but we don't have those. I don't know. Well, maybe, as he says, a small particle might be able to infect you. So we also prepare our own meals. Okay, well, that's nice, but that's not much of an idea after 2 days, buddy.
Now, what happens to him? That's another one.
Now, that there is that. That's a...
What the heck happened to Fuchs?
What happens to Fuchs, and it's a big mystery, as to why and what and for what reasons it happens. And it's a scene that's easy to forget in the movie. Just started off... It's already after MacReady is taking control, and he separated Copper and Gary and Clark and tied them down and had them drugged up. Blair is in the shack. MacReady makes the tape. You see him make the tape.
Yeah.
Nobody trusts anybody anymore. The next scene is he goes to visit Fuchs in the lab, and he talks to Fuchs about what's going on, and you know we need to, you know. We need you to come up with something. He doesn't really come up with anything. He says, I got a few ideas, but I need Blair's help. And MacReady refutes him and then leaves. And then the lights go out. And he grabs a candle and he lights a candle. Because obviously I'm just going to sit alone in the lab while there's a space monster running around. and not have a light. And he gets to the doorway, and there's a shadow that passes the doorway with scary music.
Yes.
You know, scary, or you know, like that scary organ.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so they have the scary organ. The next scene is he's running out of the, with his coat on, of the facility into the outdoors, and he's got a flare. And he runs, and he sees something in the snow, and he picks up a jacket, and it says MacReady on it. So now we're being led to believe that MacReady is potentially a thing.
Yes.
You know, because it's all ripped up, right? Because we've established by this point in the movie that the thing rips into you when it things out on you and tries to assimilate you. And then the next scene is MacReady going, has anybody seen Fuchs? The lights were in there for an hour. Lights were out of there for an hour. Anybody, any one of us could have gotten to. And this sort of sets a... you know, there's in the future they bring out that the lights went out, you know, and you know there's a scene later on when do you think it could have gotten to MacReady? Because there was again they continue to there's another scene later on when Knowles finds MacReady underwear stashed somewhere.
Yeah, obviously one of the things
is trying to bring MacReady into being a thing.
Yes, which would either
and at
be
at that point there's two things.
It's probably it would have to be either Norris or
Norris. It's Norris and Palmer or Blair.
Yeah.
No, you never know when Blair is assimilated. You'll never find out.
No, that is the thing that blows people away, and rightfully so, is you have the one character who is going to such extremes, crazy extremes, to stop this thing, and he turns out to be it.
Yeah, and he's the boss monster at the end of the game.
Yeah, and it confuses the heck out of everybody. And here's another thing. Now, if he's already assimilated completely, unless, again, this is more of him trying to convince them. If he's already assimilated, why is it when they go into the cabin, he's got a noose hanging from the ceiling? Obviously, the guy was thinking about killing himself. Unless
yeah,
it's just
funny things, and you know, the thing will go to a great extent to convince you it's the thing.
It's not the thing, you mean?
It's not the thing.
Yeah.
It's the real thing. Not an imitation.
Like Coca-Cola?
Now, getting back to Fuchs, after they go looking for Fuchs, they find his charred corpse.
Yes.
In the snow. So that means somebody murdered Fuchs. Somebody didn't even bother to assimilate Fuchs. They murdered Fuchs. Why murder him? It's a real like, you know, like, you know, it would be funny if you found out like, you know, him and Knowles had like a beef. Knowles decided to take it out like right then.
I'm inclined to think that he killed himself.
But, you know, if he killed himself, you can't light yourself on fire enough with a flare. You'd burn yourself with a flare. You need, like, to douse yourself in kerosene.
It's very strange.
You know, somebody killed him. That's my view. Why did they kill him, though? Like, it's sort of like, almost like a weakness in the movie.
Maybe they were framing MacReady.
But, I think it's possible that, one of the things, you know, when it had the opportunity, probably Blair at this point, because the other one didn't really have the opportunity, found out that he found the MacReady jacket in the snow, but somehow discerned that he didn't buy it or whatnot. I don't know. Like, they didn't assimilate Fuchs. Why not assimilate Fuchs?
See, when I watched it, for some reason, I got the idea, and again, I can't explain how he would have done it. I got the idea that he finds the evidence, right? He comes to the conclusion that MacReady is the thing, this one guy that he thought he could trust and who's right. Leading the whole group, and this leads him to commit suicide. But again,
which is plausible.
Yeah.
But the mechanism of his suicide is implausible.
Right, it is. I agree. It's very confusing as to how he would have done it, unless he had the... Unless he had access to the flamethrower.
Well, I mean, put it this way, they say, flare, maybe he tried to burn it. Maybe he burned himself before he could get to it, get to him. Okay, well, where's the can of kerosene? You know, like, they had oil and kerosene all over the place. Just show me some of that.
Yeah.
But they did, and it's a very carefully made film, so there was a reason for that scene and for the demise of Fuchs. Which is sort of like to remove the last scientist. It's like, how do we get rid? We got to get rid of this last scientist.
He knows too much, but again, still, why not assimilate him?
You right. Know?
That's
but they
the
don't.
Thing.
They Maybe don't. He. I don't know.
Maybe he's the wrong blood type.
You know, it's literally like a dead end that we'll never know the end to.
We need to ask John Carpenter if he even knows.
Recently I think the script writer, who didn't have that many scripts to his. His credit, but he had a lot of good ones, I think, passed away not that long ago.
Oh, no.
So he would be the one to ask, I think.
Yeah, he would.
One of the things that another observation I made about this film, and one of the, I think of it as a strength, is that there's several very humorous lines, many, you know, I mean, starting with the very first humorous line, which is, first goddamn week of winter. It's in the opening scene, you know, with the burning helicopter, you know. You know, you got to be fucking kidding me. And the best of them all is, I know you gentlemen have been through a lot. But when you find the time, I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter time.
Tied to this fucking couch!
But none, and even the ones that aren't intense situations, you know, like Palmer. Who might have been a thing at the time that he said this, and he had visited the saucer. By the way, two things, or two potential things, go to the saucer with MacReady. So if they were going to assimilate MacReady, bam, that's the time to do it.
Yeah.
Chariots of Gods, man. Happens all the time. They practically own South America. That's a great line, but none of these lines lighten the mood.
No, it's a very bleak movie. Very bleak.
You know, I don't know what it is, but it's weird it's pissed off. You know?
That's a great line. That's my favorite.
It's a great line, and it's funny. You know, it's you know, in any other movie, it would be a laugh line. You could put a laugh track to it. In this movie, these deadpan lines are not funny. Like, yeah, you know, you gotta be fucking kidding me. You might smile at that, and then realize that, like, that's Norris's head.
Well, it's a very hopeless movie, you know?
Oh, well, that, very, very hopeless.
Like, in the end, the end is so dark, and I mean, I don't care about spoiling anything. This is a 30-year-old movie.
No. If you haven't figured it out by now, this is spoilers.
But I come to the conclusion that Childs is without doubt the thing.
Maybe. I mean, it's, you know, I still don't have... I'm not saying that it's a certainty, but I still entertain the idea that MacReady has been a thing most of the movie.
You really think so? Good God.
It's a possibility. You know, I mean, it's a tantalizing possibility.
Now, here's
something. Talking about the communal versus hive mind versus the individual mind.
Yes.
It all could be a setup so that MacReady could just freeze.
Now, all right. Now, this may be apocryphal, and I mean, supposedly it's canon, quote unquote, because Carpenter said it was. But there was a thing video game. I wasn't even aware there was.
I have it. I never got past like the first four.
Okay. Well, apparently in the game you learn that MacReady escapes the camp, and he's the only one. Which again makes you think that Childs had to be the thing.
Well, in the video game you get there, and Childs' body is there.
Right.
You know, you get there like a couple of days. I don't know. You get there at some point later, and it's. Let me tell you, like I said, I only played like the first like one or two boards.
Yeah,
it's a scary, scary game. You know, you start off at Outpost 31, and you do like a whole like recon of it's sort of that's sort of like the you know how you learn to play the game, and then you go to like another. I think you might go to the Norwegian camp. Or something like that. You know, one thing I didn't like about the video game is that there's little things. You know, like, there's similar to, like, I guess what the Norris head is, but they're just, like, unformed, you know, like, little fleshy things that, like, hop around.
Yeah.
The thing isn't that. The thing is, you know, I don't know, more advanced than that. It's not, it's an intelligent creature. It's not an animal. Not a thoughtless animal. It's way more intelligent than us. I don't know how it got that intelligence, whether it made the technology or just knows the technology, you know, which brings on just a quick dip. There's not that many storylines that have this, but it has knowledge at the cellular level, which is something that I first encountered it in The Thing, but I first got into the concept while reading Dune, where you know things at the cellular level.
That's why the blood tries to escape from the hot needle.
Right. Well, the blood. No. Well, not just that, but like the thing knows how to build a spaceship, and it knows how to build a spaceship because it assimilated somebody that you know knew how to build a spaceship. Perhaps maybe it built its own spaceship. I don't know. But when you that blood, arguably, although some might disagree, that blood that jumps out of Palmer's dish, petri dish.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably knows how to build a spaceship.
Now, it's.
I also think that returning to a concept of body mass. I think there's a certain level of body mass that the thing needs to have in order to survive as a cohesive creature. That's again based purely on conjecture and the nature of the creature involved. You know, why not? If not, then why not just split into little tiny itty bitty like things and you know infect everybody in their sleep.
Right.
You know? Otherwise, it may not be able to maintain its knowledge. It's a very complex creature. There's a lot of different turns it could have taken.
I've always felt like it was a pretty big leap. I mean, he turns out to be right, but it's a pretty big leap for MacReady to come up with that test. Like, what in the world made him think that would be a way to tell? I mean, you know what I mean? It just seems like such a random idea and unscientific. I mean, he has nothing... really, that shows him that would happen.
A, the basis is that's what the original MacReady did in the story, Who Goes There?
Yes.
And B, I think what caused him to come up with that idea is Norris is dead, right? And then he knows Norris is dead. And then his body reacts in a certain way and attacks Copper. I think it's because it attacked Copper. You know, because MacReady looks like a dirty hippie, but MacReady isn't. MacReady is a very intelligent, logical person who, for the first time you see MacReady, he's playing chess. Maybe not well, but he's playing chess. He's a thinker. You know, if you went back to, you know, his home and wherever he came from, San Diego or Alaska, whatever, he probably has a library. He's a pilot, which means if he was in the service, he was an officer, which means he's college educated. You know, he's not Palmer. You know, Palmer's the backup helicopter pilot, by the way, and you notice they don't want Palmer to go.
Yes, that's the other thing. Oh, you know what? I didn't know that. I was trying to figure out what all their roles were, and he was the only one I couldn't figure out what the hell he was doing there.
Palmer is a mechanic along with Childs. Childs, like, takes care of the machinery, and so does Palmer, and Palmer is the backup helicopter pilot.
What is their purpose there? Is it a scientific outpost?
I ostensibly, yeah.
And if so, it seems strange. They only have, like, two scientists, and everybody else there is just support.
Well, there's you have a biologist, a meteorologist, a geologist, a doctor, a backup biologist, and then the rest is kind of like support.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Bennings is the meteorologist. You have the geologist is Norris. And you have the two biologists, Fuchs and Blair, and the doctor is Copper.
Richard Dysart, who is great.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, really, everybody plays their role perfectly. Even guys, I've never seen Fuchs or Windows in another movie. Yeah, and they do what they're supposed to do in this movie, you know?
Yeah.
David Keith is fantastic. He's a very brooding, complex character with, what does he have, 15 lines?
You know? Do you believe this voodoo bullshit? He's great. He's great.
Clark is a very interesting character. Yeah. Clark is a big guy.
He's very childlike.
He's physically imposing. He wears red flannel. The first time you see him, he's not wearing a coat. He's wearing red flannel, right? I think.
Yeah, I think so.
He's better with dogs than with human beings, and you know it. Right, you know, they purposely make that, you know.
That's his job. Now, that's his job, right?
He cares about the dogs when he finds out Blair's killed them.
Yeah.
And he's good with a knife. And being good with a knife is like, it's easy to be good with a gun. If you go with a knife, means you're willing to stick it in somebody.
Yeah.
And he's willing to do that. And he means he's done it before. Nobody gets good with a knife without having been doing it before. So that there's a, and he's not a bad guy, you know, but he's a quiet, himself, kind of loner, and because of that, he's also, you know, because of, you know, the nature of his work and his exposure to the first dog, he's immediately fingered by Blair as being a thing, or infected by the thing. Remember, at that time, it could have been a disease. They didn't know it was a space alien.
Right.
You know? So there's characters that have a lot of depth to them that, you know, you don't even really realize. You know, those two in particular. You know what? You don't know what Child's story is, but you know what are all these people doing in Antarctica?
Yeah, someone made mention of the fact, like, to be there, you had to, unless you're one of the scientists, right? To be there, you had to have pissed somebody off. There's no way you get assigned to something like that. But either that, or you are trying to cut yourself off from humanity for a reason.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, MacReady probably had enough and wanted to just, you know, get away from it. Fuchs is like the one idealistic person. You know, I think Windows strikes me as somebody that, you know, he'd rather be a photographer. He's reading, like, photography magazines, sleeping, you know. He'd rather be, in Southern California. Childs is getting away from something. Same thing with Clark. Clark would go, maybe it's just the money, you know, getting out of there. And then the older guys. What are the older guys doing there? What's Copper? Which I didn't realize this before until recently. He was wearing a nose ring.
Yes. Yes. I noticed
that. I never realized
that. What a strange choice.
You know, what's he doing? Is he gay? back in those days, like, you know, in 81, it still wasn't cool to be gay. And then what's an old guy like Blair doing there? You know, what are they lose tenure? They lose their tenured position at the University of Ohio or something?
See, for the scientists, I understand it because it could be their area of research. And the only way they can do it is by going up there certain times of the year or whatever. You know, like, that's their job. The other guys, like, and by the way, Wilford Brimley, for anybody that only knows him for, like, oatmeal commercials and diabetes.
And Escape from the Ewok Planet movie?
Yeah, to see him, because he's such a warm and fuzzy guy, and to see him in this movie is so against type, but he's the best, he's probably the best in the movie.
Well, you know, one thing I did take note of the last time I watched it is when he's bashing everything up, and they counterattack him with the table, you know, he throws everybody for a loop. Like, the Blair is, at least maybe it's the adrenaline, but whatever reason, he takes on three guys, and he sets three guys, you know, sets them ass over tea kettle.
Yes.
And, you know.
He was probably the thing already by then. Hmm? He could be the thing already by then, probably, yeah.
Right, you know, but he was a powerful, the character was both mentally powerful and physically powerful without, you know, while being unassuming about it.
Yeah. Well, I think the last big thing, and I don't know if there was anything that you wanted to touch on that we haven't talked about, but the one big thing I wanted to talk a little bit about is what exactly do we know about what it is? In other words, is it the pilot of that ship? Was it a prisoner on the ship? Is it trying to escape the planet or take over the planet? What do we know?
Nothing. We know none of that. Again, we could only surmise. The ship is literally preserved in the ice for 80 to 100,000 years, according to Doris, who's a thing at that time, so he might be going, geez, I've been here for that long. It made it out of the ship somehow, okay, to where they found it in the ice.
I think they get into that in the prequel. They explain that.
All right. You know, I have a sneaking suspicion that the story to the prequel is really good, and it's like the execution of many things that went awry. I think, like, it's a studio exec, you know, I think the studio execs messed up that movie more than anything else, from what I've, from many of the rumors that I've heard. But really, you know, if the thing could, if not survive, I mean, like, if the thing could be preserved for 100,000 years in the ice, then anything else would be preserved for 100,000 years in the ice. You don't find anything else. So the movie is telling you there's nothing else to be seen. That's my view. You know, like, movies are their own canon. This is it. This is the nature of what it is. Was it the pilot? I guess so. I mean, if it wasn't the pilot, it decided to attack the pilot. It did it at a poor time. Its timing is immensely bad. About to crash land in, like, you know, a terrible environment. You know, I think, though, that you really, these are questions that really are unanswerable. What really matters is that it came from that spaceship, and it is a mean, mean creature. It is the chameleon that strikes in the dark.
and because you see so many different forms and things coming out of it, a lot of which are so non-earthly, it makes you assume that it's been assimilating all different kinds of life forms in different places.
It could have been on a million worlds that assimilated a million different life forms. You know, it could be any one of them. You know, there are a few other things that, you know, I'd like to talk about, just my observations at least of
sure.
As time. You know, the dog thing. All right, this is the first time you hear its unworldly scream. And can you imagine what it was like to be an audience member in 82?
Yep.
And you know, you see the husky's head come apart. Right?
Like a,
you know,
flower.
Like tentacles and everything coming out of everything. You're like, what the heck is that? And then when the next time you come back, you have the classic dog thing, which is if you watch the special parts of the collector's edition of the DVD, it's really a guy's arm and an animatronic dog head. You know, and it gets up and it does that. It's. Can you imagine what it was like to be in that movie theater? People probably like ran out. They were expecting Alien. Oh, Alien! It's scary. It's H.R. Geiger. No, this is like insanity. And like, what did they think? Well, I mean, like, that is one thing. But then when Childs comes in and then it splits apart and that the dog flower comes out, that's sanity.
It's like a flower.
Which, by the way, if you read anything about it, it's really a series of dog tongues with dog teeth coming out of it.
Yeah, it's actually not.
Which is like, that's disgusting. You know, it's incredible. That monster. It's because it makes no sense. It's out of a nightmare.
Yeah. Have you ever read the Druna comics by Guido Crepax?
No.
All right. There are creatures in that very much seem to be inspired by or the inspiration for a lot of what's in the thing. You should look it up. I don't know what came first off the top of my head, but there's a lot of bizarre formless mutations that are very, very similar.
Let's see. There's also a plethora of those group pan shots, which like, they, you know, something happens, and we're going to pan around and show you everybody who's here and what they think. And over the period of the movie, like, it gets less and less. But they're all very important. You know, it doesn't go face to face to face. It's, here's the whole group. Here's everybody here. There's not a lot of camera angles. Not a lot of reverse shots. Shot, reverse shot. There's a lot of, you know, the camera work is very wide angled or, you know, all encompassing kind of things, and I think it creates the illusion of you being there. Another thought I had was the Bennings thing. All right, Bennings gets assimilated, and then they run back to the storeroom, and then it went out the window, and it's running. And it's not running well, okay? The Bennings thing is stumbling.
It's not finished.
And it turns and looks to MacReady. And it occurred to me that maybe it's when it does its thing scream, it's not trying to be scary. This is the one time the thing isn't trying to be scary. Maybe the thing is just taking a shot at saying, hey, I'm not so bad. Or can we talk about this? Or, you know...
You think it's trying to actually communicate?
I think it's a possibility. Because he looks up and he looks directly at MacReady. You know, and he knows MacReady is his main enemy. And,
seems like the only way, though, that it can intelligently communicate with them... So you would think that if it actually wanted to do that, to communicate peacefully with them, it would certainly be able to do that because it's taken over these bodies and it's speaking through them.
Yeah, sure.
But instead, the only time it chooses to speak coherently is when it's pretending to be these people. It never speaks.
True.
It never speaks as itself, even though it probably could or could.
Oh, no. There are times it speaks as itself, and I'm going to point them out to you right now.
Okay, please do.
Palmer and Norris, okay? I'm going to set the scene, okay? They go look for Fuchs. They find Fuchs. They send Windows back. Okay? And MacReady tells Knowles, we're going to go up to my shack because I left the lights off and the lights are on. Okay? Knowles finds the underwear of MacReady or the jacket of MacReady, whatever, and gets out of there, gets ahead of him on the tow line and cuts him loose in the storm and gets back to the thing on his own, right?
Yes.
He's outside right now. Windows, I actually transcribed Windows. Do you think he's changed it to one of those things? Norris. He's had plenty of time. Now, Norris is a thing at that time. Norris, he's had plenty of time. A few seconds later, Palmer says, let's open it now. Childs, why are you so damn interested?
Yes.
Palmer, because she's so close, maybe our best chance to blow it away. And he's standing right next to Norris. And they share a look in this scene. All right? They share a look a few seconds earlier. I actually started my Palmer and Norris share a look. When do you think it got to him? Palmer and Norris share a look. And then Palmer goes, the lights went out. That would have been the perfect time, says Norris. Right. And you said guys were missing and windows. Where were you? That's Palmer. Though that scene with Palmer and Norris, who are usually quiet, unassuming characters,
yes,
where suddenly they thrust themselves into the forefront, that's the thing trying to turn the tables on McCready right there.
And also
and
the fact
Palmer
that
Palmer goes, supply window. And then Norris goes, all right, we've got no choice now. Now, when he says we've got no choice, he's saying me and Palmer.
Yeah,
and we've got to get McCready now.
And the idea that Palmer is so eager to blow McCready away.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear, especially after you see the whole movie, that that's why. That he wants him out of the way because he's too smart.
he's the chess player. Now, when they mention the test, after the Norris thing and everything, Palmer visibly shudders when they talks about the blood in another group pan. All right? Windows shows kind of relief when he's tested. He sighs out. You see his shoulders sink. Because he thought I could be a thing. I could be a thing. I don't know if I'm a thing. Thank God I'm not a thing. Palmer gets this resigned look on his face. It's like, again, we talk returning to character actors. I've never seen that guy in another movie, I don't think. I don't know who he is.
He knows he's done.
You know, and he has that look. He must do theater or something because, it's so believable that 2 or 3 seconds of him just, his face darkens and it's just totally resigned. And it's like, that's it. And then when he thinks out, it's not as bad as the Palmer, as the Norris thing or the dog thing, but it's still another insane creature. You know, I'm going to have my head split open, turn into big teeth, you know, to get, you know. A few other notes here. It is, as far as I'm concerned, the thing is as really crazy and as atmospheric as Alien was, and as scary and weird as the monster in Alien was, Alien still suffers, and this isn't even just a rubber suit thing. It's a humanoid. It's got 2 arms and 2 legs and, jointed fingers and a vertebrae and, the big long tail, but still lots of things have tails.
Right, it's not
it's got
completely
a head,
alien.
It's got a mandible, it's got, a maxillary, It's got body parts that are the same body parts that you have. It's got elbows, If a thing wants to have an elbow, it's got to make an elbow. It's got to assimilate something with an elbow. It is the only creature that's truly otherworld. And if Carpenter wanted to do it, he didn't want a man in a rubber suit. The closer you get to the man in the rubber suit is the dog thing, and that's because it's a man puppet that had to make, he made it out of an arm. That doesn't count.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't want to go the route of the James Arness creature, obviously.
No, and in my view, and I said this on your blog, it is the most terrifying and it's the best movie monster. It's the best movie monster of all time. You could talk about Frankenstein, great movie monster. He's got balance because you can feel sorry for him. Dracula, is another great movie monster, but this is an entity which it steals your soul. It takes who you are and destroys you as a person. But you don't die. And you're not a zombie. You're not you anymore. But but you're genetically still alive because you've been copied.
Well, here's a question. Is it replacing your body or is it taking over your body? Does it break their bodies down and make a new one, or is it entering the body that exists? You know what I mean?
If my understanding of its nature is correct, is if it's gonna if you're attacked by the thing is gonna make Brian Thing. All right. You know, what happened to Bennings? Bennings was attacked by the remains from the Norwegian camp. Those were still there under the blanket when it ran away. It was the Bennings thing that ran away. So they had to kill the Bennings thing. You imagine, by the way, they never show you. Imagine how much it sucked to have to pick up the rest of the stuff. How did they transport the rest of the stuff into the snow to burn it? Who was grabbing the Norwegian thing? That's you know it's alive.
That's a tough job.
You know? You know, you will, even though you're dead, your soul is dead. If you believe in such a thing, you know, you're genetically going to live forever until the copier is killed, because it could turn into you anytime it wants.
Right.
And a real you, a genetically real Brian, with all the thoughts and memories of Brian up to the point that you were assimilating, which is really, really terrifying. But at the same time, the creature itself isn't soulless. It has its own soul, if there are such things. It has its own consciousness. It has its own will to live, and it's a complex will to live. It's a will to live so complex, it'll, you know, come up with a plan to get the hell out of Outpost 31 by building spaceships. Abortively, but it built a spaceship. And in its own way, it's not necessarily evil thing. It's an evil thing because it tried to assimilate some people. If we just watched it assimilating dogs, we'd be like, it's just assimilating the dogs. As long as it didn't assimilate us, we wouldn't mind. But it's evil because it attacked humans. And therefore, by attacking humans, that's, you know, thou shalt not kill. You know, it's the great sin. And I think the only thing I have left to talk about is the one thing that you've turned me on to in movies more than anything else since you started your blog, which is the score. I never paid attention to scores. So I was the kind of person that just got, you know, moved along by the music in the movie.
Yes.
You know, I know themes. I know the Jaws theme. Da, 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 da. That's the, I don't know the score. I just know that. But I paid attention to this score.
Ennio Morricone.
Yeah. And parts of it, not all of it, but part, the main thing, you know, like the dun 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 dun, you know, in the beginning.
Yeah.
I think that's the germ core of like 75% of 80s like action or police dramas on network TV. They might have had something similar to that. And I think V had a similar
theme. Yeah, it does sound there. A little bit like the start of almost like Law and Order, you know?
And there, you know, it's a very haunting. It's a heartfelt melody at times with a lot of it doesn't like. You know, there's no surprises with the score. The score isn't there to shock you. There's no like, boom! You know, when the monsters thing out, there's no music. And for a good 40 minutes or 30 minutes, there's no music in the whole movie.
It's very spare.
But when it's around, there's, you know, there's the strings and the harp that go through the Norwegian camp that just set like a melancholy, uneasy mood.
Yes.
All right, and it that mounts during the autopsy, and occasionally during certain scenes, there's a an organ, like during I think the scene when they you know what I'm saying? The organ, like almost like a pipe organ sound.
Yeah.
That like mounts like when they burn Bennings. like the conclusion of that scene. It's like, and then it ends. It's the next scene.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, there's some synthesizer in it too, but the score disappears in the middle of the movie, and it doesn't come back until much later in the movie. I think you go through the whole, you know, Fuchs disappearance, Norris thing, all the way to the end of the blood test before you get the music again.
Why do you think that is?
And then there's that one last scene inside the camp itself, and they're going around to all the rooms, sort of like what the Blair Witch Project did, you know?
Yeah.
Go around to all the rooms, it pans around to all the rooms, and you see the open door where Child should be, but he isn't. And that's when the rest of them are running around doing their thing, trying to destroy Blair, and they see Child run.
Yes.
You know, great flick. It really great. So many levels. You know, there's so many layers. We can do it. It's a murder mystery. It's just a great horror movie. There's a lot of existentialism in it. You know,
and we could probably talk about it literally for days.
Yeah, and we've been doing it now for like
over an hour. Over an hour. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we should definitely do another one, I would say, because there's so much to talk about with this movie. And
so, I'd like to, you know, I'm probably going to go out on a limb and buy the prequel tomorrow. Should be coming out.
Hey, you know, that's not a bad idea. How about if we plan for another one where we watch the prequel and then we relate it into the whole conversation about the movie?
I would be up for something like that.
What new light does it shed on it?
And then maybe let's go see Prometheus and then do the same thing for that in Alien.
Yes. We should definitely all go to see Prometheus, and we could do like a dueling review of it. I think that would be a great idea.
I think that's an excellent idea. This has been fantastic, B-Sol.
It has. I want to thank you for giving me so much of your time on a weeknight. I know you're a busy man crusading for the rights of the oppressed on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's what I do.
And I thank you for doing that. And you know what? I'm going to I might even throw some when I post this, I might throw some links up to some of the great posts that you've done for me in the past here.
Well, that'd be great. That'd be fantastic. I would appreciate that. By the way, only semi-related. There's a new H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society film that just came out, The Whisper in the Dark. Whisper in Dark.
Are they the ones that made that silent Lovecraft movie a few years back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which was pretty good.
Yeah, it was.
If I get tempted, I might have to do some sort of review of that.
I saw it at the Avon Theater, actually. It was really, really good. Well, you know what? I'm going to wrap it up, but I want to just make sure, you know, I didn't let everyone know this, and people need to know that as we did this whole conversation, Ray has been drinking a Scotch on the Rocks in the spirit of MacReady, which is way cooler than my Carlo Rossi sangria.
Unfortunately, it's not J&B.
This is what happens.
Johnny Black.
This is what happens when you get two Catholic school boys together on a weeknight.
Yeah,
we drink and we talk about scary movies. It's about as crazy as it gets when you're this age with kids. So, anyway, thank you for being a part of the Vault of Horror as always, but especially tonight, Ray. It's been a pleasure and an honor, and I can't wait to have you back.
The pleasure and honor is all mine. From the looking glass, 7 years.